everyone. Welcome back. Welcome back to the Letters and Layers podcast. Welcome to any new listeners. This is your host, Amaka. So, I am recording on Monday morning, May 13th, a couple days before I'm set to publish. I am recording with a new setup. I thought this would be like a plan B or a temporary situation, but I think this is how it's going to go from here on out. My laptop is on the older side. I've had it since 2016, and it still runs pretty decently. Like, I don't think I need to replace it, but I feel like the older it gets, there are certain functionalities that are becoming less and less dependable. And I guess I could probably like take it into computer repair and get it fixed and stuff. I would just have to kind of find the time where I wouldn't need the laptop so urgently or for anything. But that's not something I could do within the time frame that I had. And, you know, I don't want to have to go without recording. I've been very consistent since I started this podcast, which is something I'm very proud of. I have not missed episodes unless it was a planned episode or something really unexpected happened or I just couldn't do it. But I've never just been like, oh, I don't feel like it. So, you know, I'm going off like a 2.5 year streak right now, and I wasn't about to let my old computer defeat me with that. So, yeah, I've been having some issues with the connectivity with my laptop and my equipment over the past month or so, but I have been able to kind of deal. And the last time I attempted to record the episode, it kind of just like puttered out, like it wouldn't hold connection between my equipment and my laptop. So that's why I had to, you know, throw it back into one of my archival episodes, which if you hadn't listened to it when it first came out, I hope you had a chance to listen to it, because I really do love that book, What Happened to You by Dr. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey. It's one of those books that I think you should have in your library because it gives so much insight into how to interact with people and just offers context on, you know, what people might be dealing with and how folks see the world and how sometimes, a lot of times, you just can't take things personally because it's not even you. It's just kind of the role you play with the people that you're dealing with. But yeah, I do really love that book, and I had a good time summarizing that book when I recorded that episode. So if you haven't listened to my episode on that book, go ahead and give it a listen if you're interested. So I am recording from my new iPad that I bought maybe 2 months ago now, which was primarily for YouTube content and blogging. And I must admit that the YouTube part I've found is a lot more work than I feel like I could devote to, a lot more energy that I feel like I can devote to right now with everything else I have going on. So honestly, the YouTube channel is still very much something that I want to put work into, but it's just going to have to be on the back burner for now. I'm still going to be posting like my podcast episodes, but as far as like video content, I think I'm going to revisit that in a few months. Because I actually do like filming and video editing and stuff, but with everything else that I have to do, I just started to feel overwhelmed, and I really don't like that feeling. I start to cut things left and right, you know? The podcast is not something that I would ever stop doing, at least in the foreseeable future. So that is priority, along with work, along with, you know, other things in my life. And sometimes you just have to make some hard decisions. So that's kind of where I am. So yeah, it's Monday morning. It's a beautiful day. It was a pretty nice weekend in Chicago here. And I spent some time of it doing work. I had spent some time with friends. I spent some time out on the 606, which is like the High Line in New York City, if you're familiar with that walkway. So I tried to make the most of my weekend, and now I'm getting back into the work week frame of mind. But, you know, I wanted to record this episode because it is priority for me today. And I know that I said, I hope I'm not letting folks down doing this. I know I said that I was going to start Thick by Tressie McMillan Cottom today. But I was doing some blogging work over the weekend because I'm trying to create a website that has a centralized place for all my podcast print content, along with just a place where I can write, because writing is one of my first loves. And the thought of having my own personal blog where I can just share my thoughts and talk even further about books and just life just really excites me. So I'm not quite sure how much relevance blogging has still in 2024, but I don't really care about that. I'm just going to do what I want to do. Yeah, I was doing some blogging work over the weekend, and I was working on some posts where I want to highlight my favorite quotes in certain books that I've read. Some I've highlighted on the podcast that have their own episodes. And I was looking over this book I read in 2022 called You Are Your Best Thing. And it's an anthology of essays by different media personalities, writers, commentators, politicians, like what have you, but they're all Black people. And it was edited by Tarana Burke, the founder of the Me Too movement, and Brené Brown, who is a pretty well-known, like, popular psychologist. So I did an episode on this book, like, maybe 2 months into starting the podcast. It might be, like, episode 4 or 5. I think it's actually episode 4. And I highlighted an essay in that book. I think I quoted a couple paragraphs or something, but I revisited that book with the blogging work I did this weekend, and I looked up that essay again, and I remembered how much that essay moved me so much. And I actually wanted to read that essay on the podcast. So I'm pushing my discussion on Thick one more episode. I'm very sorry, but I really wanted to share this essay with you guys today. It is called Running Out of Gas, and the author's name is Sonia Renee Taylor. So that's pretty much going to be the podcast today after I read the essay. It's not like a long essay, but it is within the book. It's like 10 or so pages, and I intend to read the whole essay. So I hope you guys enjoy. This is Running Out of Gas by Sonia Renee Taylor. In early December 2012, a month after my mother's death, I sat in Sean's tight kitchen, my wide hips spilling over the sides of his sleek chrome stools. Before me, swirling in the belly of a spotless wine glass, was a Cabernet Merlot blend he had poured generously from an elegant carafe. Sean always poured his bottles of red wine into carafes first, so they might open properly, as he put it. The walls of the kitchen were a bright sunflower yellow, whose contrast against the carafe intensified the blood plum color of the wine. I lifted the glass from the table, stared into its deep garnet well, and thought of my own hauled blood flow each month. I thought of my mother's blood that once emptied out with the new moon, just as my own was soon to do, as her mother's had done, and her mother before her, and so on. A legacy of emptying. I thought about how I had rested in Terry's womb as she rested in her mother's womb. How I had always been with my mommy before she was even fully with herself. Then I thought of the mortician draining the red wine from my mommy's body before filling her with a foreign mephitic liquid, something that likely tasted of toxins and tannins. My mother died on a Thursday in late October, but began dying long before that. We hadn't spoken regularly in months. Not since she started drinking in the mornings, making my is-she-sober calculations unreliable. We were the same woman, Terry and I, always looking for a way out of ourselves inside something else, whether it be brown liquor or brown bodies. Too often, this is what the world gives Black women. Escape hatches to nowhere. Tunnels that empty into our same fractured lives. Rarely any roots to care or a soft someplace. Just the thud of falling back into the same shit we've been trying to get out of. My mother and I were a mirror loop of shame, circling our own addictions only to end up staring at the other, which was to be staring at ourselves. I'd spent every year after my 10th birthday patchworking an identity that might one day make my crack-addicted mother stay and care for me. And Terry spent every year after my 10th birthday running from the demons that made it impossible for her to care for her children. In our loops, we just kept running into our fears and away from the one thing that might have saved us both, love. Sean stood in front of the stove, stirring the onions and potatoes he was preparing along with the prime cuts of steak on broil in the oven. He was not a man fluent in the verbal exchanges of intimacy, but for nearly 20 years, Sean had cared for me like this, with wine and dinners. Short, dark-skinned, impeccably groomed, well-dressed, good-smelling, he fancied himself worldly, a Renaissance man. I would not begrudge him the title. My first dining experience at a restaurant with white linen tablecloths and coiffed male servers who pulled out my chair and rid the table of breadcrumbs using little plastic shovels happened on a date with Sean. He was a Black man who introduced me to discriminating wines, authentic reggae, and morbid videos like Faces of Death. In the early years of our relationship, we would lounge on the couch of his college apartment and watch these twisted videos. A cocky skydiver descending over a river of alligators, only to short his landing by a few feet and wind up chum in their snapping jaws. Two bottles of wine and six captured on film deaths later, we relocated to his bedroom and unceremoniously had sex. The sex occurred as an act of happenstance in our friendship, like a side effect of our genitals being in a shared vicinity. Getting naked was never presented as the intention of our time together. To consciously pair sex with our friendship would be to admit we were more than friends, admit we owed each other some truth. Neither Sean nor I was in the truth-telling business. I suppose it was ironic that we met as co-workers for a teen pregnancy prevention and education peer program. We were 19 and 20, both hired to teach safer sex, communication, and decision-making skills for middle and high school kids. A staple of the curriculum was role plays designed to help students differentiate between passive, aggressive, and assertive communication styles. Sean was often cast as the aggressive boyfriend, attempting to pressure me, his pretend girlfriend, into being sexual with him. My task was to use my assertive communication techniques to diffuse the peer pressure. Sean reveled in his villainy, committed to fraying my assertive reserve. He played dirty, stuffing grapes from the day's lunch platter in my mouth mid-sentence while moving his body so close to my own that the electric field of our attraction would short-circuit my access to language. He was a farcer, a master persuader who made me feel luscious and wanted. In the blurred margins between roleplay and reality, in front of a classroom full of eighth graders, I decided I would start fucking Sean. 16 years later, Sean and I still resided in the same nebulous expanse between friend and fuck. We never discussed the sex we had, neither before nor after. This day would be no different. The end of 2012 was a dying clock,
each second seemingly slower than the preceding one. I had 5 weeks before I was scheduled to move to California. By the time Terry died, it was agonizingly clear that nothing would keep me from throwing my body on top of and beneath anyone who might press out the grief. I was stringing together multiple states and placing them between me and every reckless decision I had made since the day the mortician handed me a pile of gray, white gravel and ash in a plastic bag inside a square black container, placed in a white cardboard box, heavy as a small toolkit, a box filled with a woman named Terry Hines, a woman I used to call Mommy. Driving to Sean's house in Philadelphia was an act of harm reduction, a last-ditch effort to kick the Jones for the person I most desperately desired to let destroy me, Kwesi. For 3 years, I screwed Kwesi to abandon myself, like my mother had abandoned me. I was at Sean's house for the same reason I would have gone to Kwesi's, but Sean was a lesser drug, methadone instead of heroin. Regardless, every person I'd ever slept with was supposed to replace my mother. They did not. And tonight, I was gonna let Sean inside me because my mommy was dead in every city of every nation on the planet, and that truth bulldozed me. Because she left me at center stage in all my shit and nothing to hold on but her ashes. I slept with people, all sorts of people, because it was what I learned to do with the sorrow in the marrow of my bones. Try to disappear it. I was starving. Sean would feed me. Not this meal he was preparing, though it was a kind gesture. Food in the past 8 weeks had been reduced to God's flavored substance people foisted on me, then watched me eat. Eating was the evidence I provided to concerned friends that I wasn't passively trying to follow Tari to wherever she had gone. No one seemed to realize I had been secretly following my mother's dead-end directions long before her earthly departure. The tined blade of each day without her peeled me, raw and ravenous for any sensation to eclipse grief for even an hour. I shuffled the meal around my plate and waited in agitation for the formality of dinner with Sean to end. He watched me in confusion. "Why aren't you eating?" "Damn, Sony, I have never seen you like this." "Sean, my mother is dead. How else would you expect me to be?" "Yeah, that's true." His considered tone intimated that perhaps he had forgotten that small detail. For all his debonair stylizing and feigned arrogance, it was obvious Sean felt minified and impotent beside the monument of sadness I had become. Grief had carved me into a new edifice, and grief had hollowed me out. We finished the meal in relative quiet, crawled into bed, and hit the light switch. Sean moved his hand toward me, disrupting the dark pocket of silence between us. A movement as predictable as death or love. He slid his cool palm inside the t-shirt he had given me to wear to bed. Another formality. Then grazed the tip of his index finger against my nipple. Here was the invitation I had come all this way for. A meal he'd offered me many times before. And without a word, I ate. The next morning, Sean made me coffee, poured it in a metal travel mug, and walked me downstairs to my car. His stiff hug was just as awkward as it had been for 16 years. "I hope you feel better." He held open the car door as I climbed inside. He turned toward his house and disappeared behind the paint-chipped white plywood door. I pulled out of the driveway and down his narrow street. By the time I got to the first stoplight, I was hungry again. Leaving a DC work meeting a few days after my visit with Sean and a week past Thanksgiving, I headed down New York Avenue towards Route 50 and the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, toward what should have been a straight shot home. Instead, I made a left-hand turn on Minnesota Avenue. This rerouting was as outside of any conscious machinations as blinking or swallowing. It was automatic. Going to Sean, feeding the hunger, had turned over an ignition inside me, one I had no key for. I was a revving engine, a car stuck in drive. I would not stop until I ran out of gas. Here I was, not wanting to, but nevertheless driving north toward the DC neighborhood of Columbia Heights, toward Quaysey. I looped 16th Street toward Harvard Street with its shoddy and souped-up brick homes, set back far enough for the inhabitants to have fenced front yards, then drove back up 14th Street past 7-Eleven and Target, then across Park Road and over to 16th Street again. I study the profiles of black men's faces in the dark along the way. Is that a goatee? No, his beard is too thin. I examine their frames, quickly excluding those whose bodies rose above 6 feet. His pants are too tight. He's walking too fast. I perform this ritual of circle and investigation, identification and elimination, no fewer than 10 times for the next hour looking for Quaysey. I finally pulled my car in front of Mark's Cafe off 16th Street, parked in the no parking zone, and screamed in outrage, "Fuck you!" I'm sorry, I broke character. To an identity that was both me and Quaysey and God and no one. And the engine in me and me inside my car both sputtered and stalled, my tank finally empty. To the left of my car, the restaurant bar pulsed with strange bodies I could see through the glass front door. DC newcomers sipping Cuba Libres and taking swigs of craft beer under the Titan lights. Mark's is served as evidence of the ever-lightening complexion of Chocolate City. A white-owned communist-themed bar in a brown neighborhood, indifferently belched up from the gut of gentrification, without so much as an excuse me to anyone. My self-righteous judgment did not stop me from routinely sitting at the bar opposite Quaysey, watching the contours of his hands and mouth as he quartered then swallowed his glass of Makers on the rocks, as I took deliberate sips of vodka tonic with a squeeze of wine just before we ambled our way back to his attic or basement only a few blocks down the street. As was our cycle, Quaysey had stopped answering my calls shortly after I visited him with my mother's cremains in tow. He did as he said he would that day, fucked me like my husband, but he had no intentions of treating me as such. Initially, I feigned gratitude. His rejection was helping me prepare for my move. He was doing me a favor by extracting himself from my life. For the first few weeks after that, I made myself busy with online Bay Area house hunting, researching moving companies, and being ambushed by sorrow nightly. When the hook of sadness hitched itself to my chest and towed me through the day, I would masturbate before bed to augment the pain with some facsimile too flat and gray to call pleasure, but better than the hook. Soon the facsimile rendered itself useless. The week it stopped working, I drove to Sean's house. I fed the beast, and now outside the Mark's Cafe, it would not stop growling at me from inside my own belly. I sat in the car, seething and buckled under my own lack of self-control. Even still, on a muted internal channel, I continued willing Quaysey to actualize off of 16th Street in my blurred field of vision. My phone rang abruptly. The sound of the ringtone physically hurt, an unwelcome auditory pinch that shoved me back into my body. I fumbled through my purse and answered. My therapist, Dr. Byron, was calling, as she did several times a week since my mother died, an extension of care far beyond her therapeutic duties. There had been a rotating cast of therapists over the years, a series of fits and starts that were as much a function of my unreadiness to face the emotional closet, collapsing in real time under the weight of my self-delusion, as they were a result of a host of professional ineptitudes and mismatches. Neither my inability to cease sexual relations with Quaysey, nor my mother's unwinding thread of sanity chased by Seagram's gin, led me to the couch of the middle-aged, gingered-haired woman with long limbs and gracious eyes. Flight anxiety was what finally forced me into therapy in 2011. I began having full-on panic attacks prior to boarding planes. I took 2 flights a month on average and much of my income depended on air travel. Not until my trauma began to edge itself into the territory of my fledgling economic security was I even remotely willing to peek at it. For the first year, I saw Dr. Byron weekly, mostly over video sessions, but she had called daily the first 2 weeks after Terry died, when I was in Virginia. She talked to me for an hour as I stood in a public laundromat, washing and folding the 13 loans of flea-infested, mildewed shirts, sheets, and socks left abandoned in my mother's laundry room, some sopping and soured in her broken washing machine. The fleas were the remaining evidence of the lonely desperation that compelled her to take in a stray dog a month before she died, a litany of beginnings and tragic endings. Dr. Byron accompanied me as I navigated the mundanities of death and the bureaucracy of dead people business. Later, I would share with her how death dragged madness out of me, how I sat on my bedroom floor for 2 hours, my hands plunged wrist deep into the container of ashes in my lap, how I felt possessed by a compulsion to scoop up 2 palms worth of my mom's gravelly bone fragments and eat them, to be full with Terry. Dr. Byron was the only one who knew in graphic detail how I wanted to, was willing to, put anything in my mouth, anything in my body to fill up the nothing. Dr. Byron knew a part of me had died with my mother. She knew, when I did not, that a part of me needed to. "Hi, Sonia. How are you?" she said. "I don't know, Dr. Byron," I replied, jaw still tight with anger that my diablerie had not conjured up Quasi. I lied to everyone but her. Each week she presented me with an empty bowl of reproof and teeming with grace. Despite my best efforts, I could not help but pour honesty into such a sacred container. It took me a year into our sessions before I could look her directly in the eyes. She would say, "You're lovable, Sonia," and I would bow my head like a serf at such an implausible idea. During an appointment, I told her I felt indomitably unlovable, that even she loved me only because I paid her. "No, Sonia," she said. "You pay me for my time. You do not pay me to love you. I choose to love you." Dr. Byron is where I tried on intimacy like I tried on my mother's heels as a child. The shoes flopping about on my tiny feet. So much space to grow into. "Dr. Byron, I have been driving around in circles for an hour trying to run into Quasi," I said. A flush of shame followed the words. "What is it that you want from Quasi, Sonia?" she asked. I started to say, "To screw, duh," when I caught my own lie and swallowed it mid-sentence. I wanted Quasi to do the impossible. I wanted him to fill the hole. The empty in me was an entire planet, a solid celestial body insistent on being acknowledged. My sortilege did not summon Quasi. It summoned only my acute awareness of the complete globe of nothingness, an impermeable mass that had taken up residence in the negative space where my mother used to live. Nothing could be done with the whole, but I drove in circles for an hour praying someone, not someone, Quasi, would split the grieving world of me into manageable pieces. I wanted him to... The rest of the sentence was atomized in a planetary collision of mourning. My chest heaved as I bayed into the phone. "I know, dear. I know. You miss your mommy." For 15 minutes, my therapist rocked me feather soft on the other end of a phone while I howled and cursed a world devoid of Terry. And as quickly as a blackjack dealer might flip the final card in a hand, laughter turned me over. How absurd I must have looked, menacing DC in the dark, stalking short black men. I must sound full-blown crazy. I have really been lurking around DC like a stalker tonight. And 2 seconds ago, I was in hysterics. "Dr. Byron, I'm losing it." No, you are not, Sonia. You are simply in this new moment. Grief was here. Now, in this moment, there is laughter. You can welcome both. In the first months without my mom, I was learning how to be both. How to be with all of me, the whole. I ended my call with Dr. Byron and started up my car. I drove toward Baltimore. It was 9:45 p.m., time to go to bed. I looked down at the fuel gauge, slightly concerned. No worries, I would make it home. My gas tank was full. So, that was my favorite essay in the book, You Are Your Best Thing. One, because it was so raw. I don't know if I've read anything more raw than that essay, ever. It felt like it was too intimate to know as a person who was struggling with some form of sex addiction, who was using it to mask and kind of numb the grief of their mother who had let them down throughout their life, but still was grieving her being gone. Because many of us are familiar with the complicated feelings we might have around mothers, how they might have disappointed us, how they might not have been there for us. But at the same time, when they're no longer with us, we still are dealing with that grief. And we have to try and figure out how to position the grief of them being gone next to the disappointment we have with them not being there while they were alive. I definitely get that from this essay. And I appreciate her honesty around her struggle with sex with these two different men. And these are only the two men that we know of. These are the two men that she wanted, that she felt comfortable talking about in this essay. And I'm not going to assume anything, but the essay for me gives me the impression that these were just two men of others. These were just two men that played a role in some form or fashion in the process that she was going through around the death of her mother. And I just love how she used her words in this essay. I love how she used metaphors. I love how it was just how she just built a world with her words and let us in how she was feeling in such a tangible way. And she almost kind of builds an arc towards the end of the essay when she starts seeing her therapist. She starts talking to Dr. Byron and she explains how this is not her first stint with therapy, but because the panic attacks were starting to impede on her ability to make a living because she had to travel for work. She was like, okay, I need to get back into therapy. And she started to see Dr. Byron. And from what I gather from the essay, she had struggled with therapy in the past. Maybe she hadn't found who was the right fit for her. But Dr. Byron did not give up on her. And she felt comfortable enough with her to be completely open and transparent. And even when she did, Dr. Byron received that and told her that what you're doing right now might feel crazy to you, but you are processing your grief in the best way that you know how. And I am willing to walk alongside you in this journey. And kind of having Sonia know this from her therapist gave her the littlest bit of fight and strength to stop what she was doing, to leave that bar where she was trying to conjure up Kwesi and go home. So reading this essay again brings me right back to the first time when I read it. I remember starting it and stopping it a couple of times because it just felt so hefty in the emotion that she put in it. And I still think about this essay sometimes. So I was going through the book for my blog yesterday and I came across the essay again. I was like, you know what? I know I had original plans for this episode, but I want to read this essay. So, you know, I hope you enjoyed the essay. It's called Running Out of Gas by Sonia Renee Taylor. She is an author. She has other book titles. Feel free to Google her, get into her work if you enjoyed that reading of her work. And I'm going to end the podcast here. So I want to thank you guys for listening. If you made it to this point, I'm very happy that this new configuration of my recording is working out. So this is going to be how it's going to be for the foreseeable future. Feel free to reach out to me as always. Email me at contact@thelettersandlayers.com. Reach out to me via Instagram @amaka_ag. Please rate and review if this episode or past episodes have positively impacted you. And please share. Please share to folks who you think will enjoy this podcast. And as always, thank you so much. I appreciate you guys. And I'll talk to you in the next episode. Bye. Thank you.